Hello and welcome to Lives and Times of the Judges, a series of interviews with former judges of the Federal Court of Australia. Today I'm talking to the Honourable James Allsop, ACSC, whose career has included 7 years as a Federal Court judge between 2001 and 2008, followed by 5 years as President of the New South Wales Court of Appeal. In 2013, he returned to the Federal Court as its fourth Chief Justice, a position he held until 2023. So, with the three positions in mind, what are his thoughts on reaching a judgment?
The process of decision-making is fascinating. I mean, that's a day's discussion in itself. But the law generally oozes out of the facts. And being a judge is fascinating. But what was also fascinating in being a judge was the difference in first instance trial work on the one hand and appellate work on the other, and they're quite different functions. The first is a creative act through the trial process, the reconstruction of the past. It's a mixture of history, journalism, and imaginative recreation. Not imaginative in the sense of making it up, because it's based on the evidence, but one has to place oneself in the past and make a decision as to what happened based on the evidence. And these cases are developed incrementally as material is brought forward through witnesses, whereas the appellate process is a post-mortem. You have a dead body, you have a body formed, which is what was created, and through the notice of appeal and the arguments, you're told where the asserted errors are that have to be corrected. And it's an entirely different mental process of taking what's before you and seeing if it was correctly formed, as opposed to trial work. It's far more burdensome, but there's a certain beauty to it. And you see that in the most mundane cases of people having their problems solved. They're small problems to you, but they're not small to them. And that's why I used to get personally very upset, although I didn't always show it, when you hear judges say that, oh, I don't like doing that sort of case, it's boring. And there's nothing boring about anything as a judge. It's the process that's fascinating. The content's sometimes easier to deal with than other content. But, you know, running a bankruptcy list is a huge responsibility and a privilege to do. But not many people look at it like that.
I've asked everyone I've interviewed, and this seems a good time to ask, what makes a good judge?
Life experience, patience, wisdom, good legal knowledge, and human decency. Not 15 pages of criteria that has just recently been published.
Presumably, being a judge on any court is the pinnacle of anyone's career.
Yeah, it wasn't something that, if it never happened, I would not have felt as though I'd failed in some ambition. When it was offered to me, I was surprised and thought about it. And we thought about it in the family and decided that, well, if I didn't like it, I could always stop doing it.
So how did the appointment of the judge to the Federal Court come about?
I was asked by one of Chief Justice Black's New South Wales recruiters, then Justice Lindgren, as to whether I would like to think about doing it, and I thought about it. And it was the same in my day. There were always scouts out there who were asking people that the court might want to have on the judge. Of course, it's not a matter for the judges. It's a matter for the executive. In those days, there was no committee or formal process of application or anything like that. And so I was asked and said I'd be interested.
And did you have regrets leaving the bar?
Yes and no. I was involved in a particularly long and difficult case, which I'd been in for some years, that was likely to consume my life for the next few years anyway. And I had some interest in becoming a judge, and I thought it was as good a time as any to try.
What was it like being on the bench?
It was most unusual. It took me about 6 months to stop objecting to questions, and instead of that, rejecting them. But it takes at least 3 or 4 years to really settle in and to acclimatise to what you're doing. I used to say to new judges, well, there's a couple of consequences. One is you just got your Sunday afternoons back. And secondly, you have to write the last paragraphs. So it's no longer working out what all the arguments are. It's actually deciding. And getting your Sunday afternoon back is not having your life dominated by performance stress. People don't understand how difficult that is and how affecting it is on people's personal lives and family lives.
Are you a natural performer, do you think?
No, I'm not. Barristers tend to fall into one of two categories. The ones that have to fight performance stress and bring about their best notwithstanding the stress, and the ones who feed on the stress, for whom the stress is the vitalising force. But everyone has to deal with that stress.
Surely that hinders your job.
No, you have to fight it, but it's what sharpens the mind. And in an adversarial system, you argue for your client and you have to put the case for your client. And the more experience you get, that is, the more time that you've been at the bar, and as you learn and improve, the harder the cases get. So you never get ahead, because the wave behind you of the kind of case you're doing means that you are getting more and more responsibility.
So the stress of fighting for your client, how does that differ from the stress of having to decide a case as a judge?
There's no performance stress anymore. You have to decide. There's a large responsibility, but you're not performing.
Let's look a little bit at your career at the bar and the sort of litigation you were doing, because your main practice has been commercial, intellectual property. It's a broad practice, but what attracted you to that area?
As a barrister, you get what you're given. You end up in a set of chambers and you never know where the work comes from. You never know why people brief you. And I always used to say to my associates going to the bar, the only thing to do is to make sure you try and do every single piece of work as well as you possibly can. And if you do that, you'll probably get the work next time from the solicitor on the other side. And I did a lot of insurance work, insolvency, general commercial, equity, later IP and tax, trade practices, banking, and just general commercial stuff. The first 7 to 8 to 9 years of being at the bar were really very stressful. And it wasn't until I'd been at the bar for about 9 or 10 years I thought, no, I can do this, and really began to start enjoying it.
You've been quoted on numerous occasions as saying that litigation is the failure of the law.
It's not a failure of the law. The expression I've used, it's the failure end of the law, by which I meant, and I got this perspective when I was working with Kim Santo and David Gonski, two of the finest lawyers I've ever met and two of the finest people I've ever met. With the exception of organisations like insurance companies that through their commerce have disputation almost necessarily part of their business, going to court for most people is a disastrous experience. It's a costly and stressful but necessary evil. And it should be approached in that way, that it's the substitute for the gun and the gang.
You're well known for your great knowledge of history and your love of history. How important is that knowledge of history to your makeup as a judge?
That's a very good question, because the law has the great capacity to narrow people, because it is so intense, and because as a practitioner, the stuff that you have to keep reabsorbing and with new legislation, new this, new that, there's a constant demand to be completely on top of all the legal material that is there to be analysed, to the point where it's very easy to stop reading anything else. After you've read 500 or 600 pages almost every day and you go home, it's not easy to sink into an Anthony Trollope novel.
So let's go right back to your decision to become a lawyer, because I gather that, in fact, you started off studying law at university and then found it so boring that you switched, you just did your arts degree and went into teaching.
That's right. That's exactly what happened. He's a very nice man who was my lecturer at the time, but I couldn't see the point. What I didn't understand, and young people, you know, straight out of school, that it's hard to understand, is that to think about the law and to begin to understand it, you have to ingest all this stuff. It's a bit like learning anatomy. If you want to become a doctor, you just have to learn all the anatomy. And there's nothing interesting about it. It's just this vast body of stuff you have to learn. And that's what it looked like to me, and I couldn't see through that. And so I went back to American and Australian history and economics and politics.
And yet that didn't satisfy you.
Well, I so trashed my arts degree. As I was teaching, as I was growing up a little bit, not much older than the students I was teaching, I began to get the bug to go back to study. So I went back and saw my old history professor and asked whether I could somehow do an honours degree. And he looked at my file and asked whether I'd tried in my last year. And I thought, well, I should have said yes, but only given the other distractions that I had. I said yes. So he closed the file and said no. If you were trying and that was the result, that was it. So I'll go and study law.
And you went from being a past student in the arts to winning the university medal.
And yeah, I won the university medal, but someone else should have won it. And it wasn't her fault that she didn't. There was a group of us who were so-called mature age students. We were all of 23 or 24 or 25. And the way the honours was worked out at Sydney University was they just added your marks up. And there was she and I and one or two other people used to always compete for the marks. And she was always 15 to 20 marks ahead of me because I always had 51% in administrative law. And she had a baby in her last year and her husband left her while she was pregnant and she didn't do as well in her last year as she might have otherwise.
Your career has been quite blessed. You know, after that bumpy start, you were an article clerk at Freehills and then you were called up by the federal court to come for an interview as an associate with the first Chief Justice, Nigel Bowen.
Well, there was a wonderful, she's passed away, there was a wonderful woman, Alicia Soon Tay, who was married to a philosopher, Eugene Kamenka, at the ANU. And she was a remarkable woman, just a remarkable intellect, and she taught jurisprudence at Sydney University. And Alice used to procure the medalist for Sir Nigel every year. And I said to Alice Tay when she rang me, she said, you have an interview the following day. And I said, but I'm working at Freehills. She said, who are you working with there? I said, well, it's Kim Santa and David Gonski. She said, oh, don't worry about that. I'll speak to Kim. So I left and went for about 9 or 10 months with Nigel Bowen, then went back to Freehills.
I have only heard huge amounts of praise for Sir Nigel Bowen, that he steered a very difficult path as the first Chief Justice of the Federal Court or Chief Judge of the Federal Court in, you know, hostile terrain. What were the hallmarks of his personality that made him so good at what he did?
Well, first of all, he was one of the best lawyers of his generation. People talk about Barwick dominating the bar in the 50s. He was a lion of this Sydney bar in the 50s and 60s. They both went into politics. Bowen could have been prime minister, but for circumstances. And he left politics and became the chief judge in equity and then a member of the Court of Appeal. And when they set up the court, he was asked to be the chief judge. His qualities were his capacity as a lawyer, his strength of personality, and his gentle calmness. I only saw him angry once or twice, and the manifestation of that would pass muster today. He was a gentleman. It's an expression that's not used these days, but he was a gentleman, and he demanded of those around him to create a civilized, polite, highly intellectual court. And it was in a day when appearing in some of the courts of the state was almost physical experience, that it was like a body contact sport sometimes. It was a generational thing. Not everyone, by any means. There were judges in the Supreme Court as a baby barrister in the early 80s that you knew you would be treated with courtesy and respect, and your clients would be given the dignity and respect to which they are entitled. But there were also a larger number of judges and masters and registrars who were less than gentle. By and large, all that's left the judiciary now. But Nigel Bowen knew that if you were starting a new court, the one way that you could attract jurisdiction was by having practitioners want to come to your court. And so he understood. He never said this to me, but it was only as a head of jurisdiction that I kind of worked it out. He knew that people would come back to the court if you treated them politely, especially the young ones. Bowen went to the bar in about 34. Barwick went to the bar, I can't remember when, 28 or 29, maybe 30. And Nigel, he was 24, he was born in 1910. Barwick was older than that. He was in his 30s when the war broke out. And Bowen went to the war, and he said, when I got back in 45, I wrote to all my solicitors who had briefed me to say, I've returned to practice. And one solicitor rang him up and said to him, in kind of quite self-righteous terms, that we wouldn't be able to brief you now. We brief Mr. Barwick now. He looked after us during the war.
So Sir Nigel Bowen didn't look after them by going and fighting for them.
But that was a real divide in post-World War II Australia. The men who went and served and the men who didn't. And it was the only time I sort of ever saw Nigel sort of grit his teeth. And he sort of, just remembering it still made him cross.
So what was his war like? Because I know you've got an anecdote about that.
One anecdote. Bob Ellicott gave it at his memorial service in St. James when he died in 1994. He was in a small boat mapping the coast of New Guinea with the Japanese not far away. And in the boat, there were two other servicemen, and it was Ninny and Stephen and Frank Packer. So what a boat. They were brave men too, all three of them.
Continuing that nautical theme, James Allthorpe is well known for his interest in maritime and admiralty law. In fact, he's known in some circles as the Admiral.
Yes, well, Michael Pelly gave me that name. Thank you, Michael. I was lucky enough to be briefed by a firm of solicitors in Ibsworth and Ibsworth on admiralty and shipping matters. And I soon became fascinated by it, not because of any particular romance about it. I'm not a sailor myself. But it's a fascinating subject because it's not the law of a place, it's the law of an activity. And if it is the law of a community, it's the law of an international community of seafarers.
And of course, it's an amalgamation of many laws going back hundreds of years as well. So it does have that level of romance to it.
Yeah, no, exactly. And its formulation from its sources is deeply historical, going back past the time of nation states, where the notion of supranational wasn't necessary because there weren't nation states. And it goes back to the Romans and the Greeks and the city-states of Mediterranean Europe.
Australia is a maritime nation. I mean, in the sense that it's a place that has depended on trade for absolutely everything.
Well, we have one of the biggest maritime tasks of any country in the world. The amount of shipping that goes in and out of this country is vast. We have one of the biggest maritime responsibilities, being an island continent surrounded by water. Yet for many Australians, we're a land girt by beach, not by sea.
But of course, it's also about sovereign borders and that aspect of maritime law as well. Let's talk a tiny bit about that. Keeping people out, letting people in, that kind of jurisdiction.
Well, the sea is a natural form of border. When I first came to the court, this issue was front and centre with a certain vessel.
That's the Tampa.
Tampa, doing public international law required it to do, which was to take on board people in distress. At the same time, the refusal of Australia to allow that ship to berth. I was in Malmo, Sweden, about 4 years later, when I was participating in the governing board of the World Maritime University, and I was berated because I was an Australian by a Norwegian or a Dane for what he saw as a terrible infringement or a violation of international law. Now, there was a huge debate at the time as to whether it was technically a breach of international, public international law. But I came to the court when that controversy was exploding all around me.
You weren't actually part of that decision. That was in the time of Michael Black.
It'd be hard to pick a better court than that court. It was Justice Beaumont and Justice French. And it was a very powerful court.
Yes, and Chief Justice Black discussed that in his podcast as well. What about the role that politics plays in the legal world? Obviously, ideally, they're separate, but there have obviously been lots of political influences that come to bear on a lot of quite high-profile cases over the years.
Yeah, I mean, politics is a very broad concept. The federal court deals with, as do all courts, deal with power. That's what courts deal with. They control power, whether it's private power or public power. The essence of judicial power, it's one of the unique powers that exist in society because its essence is protective. Protective by declaring who's right and who's wrong, what the extent of the right is, enforcing it, giving compensation for wrongs that have caused injury or damage to rights, and limiting power, identifying the limits of state power on the individual, whether it's protecting one state against another state. It's all about a notion of ultimate protection of society, not by being nice or kind or gentle necessarily, although kindness and gentleness are not foreign to judicial power. But within that, when one's dealing with politics, you are not a politician. You are not exercising the will of anyone. You are identifying legal rights and obligations and dealing with them. Now, one's own background and personality and necessarily come into that, but party political allegiance plays no part in it. And the federal court has had a number of former politicians. Sir Nigel was the best example, but there were Labor politicians as well as Liberal national politicians who've been judges and very good judges. The most important thing, I think, and got lost sight of sometimes in, certainly in the 1990s when I was at the bar, I used to look at some of the things and the way they were being set, is that politicians and judges have a responsibility to accord the institutional respect to each other that they deserve. And they each have their field of authority. But the great difficulty is that the borderlands of power are not written in clear, bright lines. And it was a wonderful professor of constitutional law, Cheryl Saunders from Melbourne, who first made this illumination in me when I said, but what exactly is the limit of this power here? And she said, there is no definitive line there. The executive and the judiciary each have a responsibility to stay away from the edge.
That's really interestingly put.
It's how she put it, and I went, wow. And she said, because I might say the line is there, the next person might say the line, and crossing the line is very important not to do, so you have a responsibility to stay away from the edge. Too often people think about law in terms of lines and rules and definitions, which are hugely important if you're going to have a textual-based legal system. But most important things can't be defined. And you actually often get greater certainty by thinking about a space rather than a line. Mm-hmm. And if you say, exactly where does my power end and the next person's power exist? That is, where does judicial power end and where does executive power begin? It's just a false question. There is no exact place.
Mm.
It depends. And the more important question is, at what point will it become doubtful that your power is there?
There are some areas of law where those edges may attract public attention much more, native title being one of them. Were you involved in many native title cases?
A number, but all mine ended in consensual determinations. I did not ever have a long, drawn-out native title case. It's been one of the, and I've said this before, and been one of the great achievements of the federal court in terms of how it has dealt with native title. Not the results, but the mechanisms of dealing with it very early on. And it was under Michael Black's regime, if I may use that expression. Decision was made to hear cases on country, which was quite controversial, as I recall. There were people who thought, well, why should these litigants be any different? They should come to court, come to us, not we go to them. But the hearing of cases on country recognised the necessity for the context and the place of country, and that that was the only place where it was appropriate to hear evidence of spiritual another connection to country. And it was part of, a big part, I think, a part of the confidence the court built in First Nations people, trusting this court in how it was dealing with their cases as historic generational cases, as well as having the confidence of the other litigants, the governments and the non-Indigenous landholders and interested parties. It's one of the places, I'm not saying it's the only court in the country, but it's one place that First Nations people view as their court.
In the 5 years between being a judge of the federal court and being appointed its chief justice in 2013, great strides had been made in modernising its communication system. It allowed for a reappraisal of the federal court as a court of specialisation.
The year I arrived back as Chief Justice, the electronic court file was being rolled out. So within a year of my starting as Chief Justice, the whole court file was digital, which meant anyone and any number of people could know what was happening in a file from any part of the country, indeed any part of the world. It enabled a Chief Justice to organise the court along national lines. And I had thought about the court a lot when I was a judge on the court until 2008. And one of the abiding disagreements amongst judges during that 7 years I was on the court was the notion of the importance or the lack of importance of a degree of specialisation and familiarity with the subject matters judges were doing. There were some judges who took the view that every judge in the court should do every aspect of the work of the court, no matter whether she or he had any real familiarity with it from practice or from study and preparation. I had the view, as did a number of others, that it was not an appropriate presentation to the public and the profession to say that the specialisations and deep skills of particular areas should not be recognised in at least giving those members of the public and profession judges who understood those particular areas. And you had areas as diverse as intellectual property, taxation, public law, labour law, corporations law, admiralty and maritime, native title. Of course, any intelligent judge properly read up and trained could deal with all of them. But the effect on the public of saying, as one walked onto the bench in the first day of a difficult patent case, well, good morning, this is my first patent case. Is someone going to explain to me the difference between obviousness and novelty? That happened in front of parties who had spent millions of dollars in a very expensive and very important patent fight about a pharmaceutical, being confronted with a judge who knew not the first thing about patent cases.
So now we have a federal court where there's areas of specialisation.
Well, it's all to do with the listing of the court. What I attempted to do, and it wasn't me, it was the unanimous view of the judges of the court in August to September 2014, where we adopted the National Court Framework, which divided the work of the court into its great subject matter areas, and judges were placed into that depending on the volume of work. There were judges who would do the local registry work at first instance, and the appellate work of the court broadly sought to reflect the specialisation of the judges. That did not mean that one couldn't develop a specialisation if one was interested, because there has to be a regeneration of skill, and you can't always just rely upon practitioners who had that particular specialty. But what it did attempt to do was to create, if you like, courts within a court. It's a very bad thing to create an isolated court, I think, that just does one thing, because what you get is a narrowness and a sort of an insularity of approach. A tax court or an IP court or a labour court, that the judges only do that subject matter, leads to, I think, a narrowness and insularity. But that doesn't mean that within a larger court you can't have the satellites working inside, where broadly the people doing IP can be viewed as an IP court. It doesn't mean that that's all they do, and it doesn't mean that people can't do IP who have never done it before. And my vision of it was that I would try and have senior judges in those areas take charge of the development of that specialty within the court. And it was not easy to do, but that was the broad vision that was agreed to by all the judges in 2014. And it was to give the public a real sense that in a court that did difficult specialties, that the judges that would hear them were familiar with and across those specialties, because litigation is extremely expensive.
I recently read a paper you gave about artificial intelligence, and you start off by praising what artificial intelligence can do in a legal setting, but you end by talking about that human intelligence and human perspective that cannot possibly be synthesized in AI. And I'd like to talk about that because, of course, you presided over a court that had always embraced new technology and that was very much at the forefront of it. And now artificial intelligence is something that every court has to embrace. It can't ignore.
I think that's right. And the world has been created, and our social existence has been created and framed by science and by the development of technologies and the existence of vast bodies of digital information are not capable of being read and understood otherwise than through a machine. We've created this, I use the expression, choking thicket of information. It's not only information, but communication of information, such that 30 or 40 years ago, in a building case, a piece of paper would be circulated to 8 people in ascending order of authority until you finally got a sign-off of the person who had ultimate authority with the views and comments of each person. Now you would have an exponential number of emails and communications that would reflect 3 days' reading compared to the reading of one document in 5 minutes. And that kind of exponential growth in information, just the volume of judgments, the volume of letters, the volume of emails, we need some form of synthesization of information that can, if there is a binary answer, to reach that answer, or if there are alternatives, to understand possible alternatives. That said, that's not actually what gives the importance to the process of the legal system, because most matters that come to court have no one correct, in inverted commas, answer. If there were a binary answer that could be reached, someone would have reached it before getting to court. They involve individual facts along the way that might have a binary answer, but ultimately most of them involve a question of judgment, and those judgments can be mimicked, but they're mimicked. It looks like a human set of reasons. The result is one to which a human could reach, so, and you expect people to live with the answer, then you say, oh, well, the machine says this. This is the correct alternative. What do you mean? Where the system gains its confidence is the understanding that there's been an impartial, dutiful human engagement with the problem, and to the extent that there's a value-based choice made, that that's explained. There are dispute resolution mechanisms today that run on AI. If you have a dispute about what you bought on eBay, they don't have people sitting down looking at your file. They run it through a machine, and they have the profile of the seller and the profile of the buyer, or if there is one, and they reach a result. Yes, you can have your money back. Well, no, you can't. You don't need any reasons. You get it done. But it's all right. It's only over $200. But if you're going to be deported or not, if you're going to have your children taken away from you by the welfare, or if you're just going to be made bankrupt, that's a disaster for most people. To have a machine doing it, what's going on? Now, maybe society in 50 years' time will accept it because it can't afford the system of having human judges. Okay, but recognize what it is. It's a machine working on probability and mimicking human condition. The fact that you can mimic any judgment doesn't mean it's the judgment. And I tried to illustrate that by 3 examples in that paper. One was the Paul Finn example. Paul Finn died last year. He was a wonderful man, great scholar, and he was a great federal court judge. And he had an Iranian man in front of him, one of our migration cases. And this Iranian man said at the end of the case, I do not mind what the judge does. I have seen him. He is a spiritual man who treated me with such dignity. I know he will do what is right, or words to that effect. And this happens day in, day out in our criminal courts, you know, not with the poetry of the Iranian, but with the silent notion of people that whether or not they should be convicted, whether or not they should win or lose, they feel at the end of it that this is a process that they respect and will abide by.
Well, James, thank you so much for such a fantastic conversation.
Well, it's my pleasure.